a good dog. I'm Joanne Green. Notice that we're outside. Can you hear this? Little birds in the background.
Sleeping dog on the couch.
Absolutely. The couch, that's just a
chair.
Piece of lawn furniture. I'm here today with Trish King, who's the author of Parenting Your Dog. This is very civilized sitting out here.
Oh, it is, absolutely.
You probably get to be outside during work every now and then, huh?
Oh, all the time. I don't like sitting it behind a desk, and so it's a great job for me.
And dogs prefer to be outside, don't they?
They prefer to be wherever people are. Betcha Lulu would be inside if you were inside.
Oh, you are absolutely right. If I was in the bathroom, she'd be in the bathroom. She follows me everywhere I go.
Yep.
And is that pretty standard?
Most dogs. Certainly not all dogs, but an awful lot of dogs do.
But they want to go for that walk more than anything else, right?
Well, of course.
And why is that? I mean, I love to go for my walk, too, so I kind of understand it. But I don't sniff everything. We have different needs.
Well, you have different senses, too. If you had a dog's nose, you would be smelling things all over the place, and that's how they get all their information about the world, is nose first, and then ears, and then eyes. They don't really have very good vision.
What does it look like? Can you tell us? I mean, in other words, are they, for instance, colorblind? Do they see kind
they're,
of
They used to think that they were colorblind, but they're not totally colorblind. They can see... They're kind of red-blue colorblind, or is it red-green?
Red-green.
Red-green. They can see muted colors, but they don't really see specifics very well, which is why, you know, we were talking about in an earlier episode that they might look at someone with a hat and not realize it's a person and all that kind of stuff. And so,
oh, yes. Lulu barks at inanimate objects regularly.
Oh, yes, of course. Because they're looking at they see outline and motion. So they see things moving and they see kind of the outline of things. And then they have to get fairly close to see something, you know, specific. And in fact, I guess, don't quote me on this, but I was reading a study where they said that something like 75% of German Shepherds and 80% of Rottweilers are nearsighted, just absolutely nearsighted. And if you think about the reactivity of German Shepherds, which you probably have never thought about, but I have, you can really see that that they, you know, bark first, think afterwards. So,
now, is there any correlation between why that would make them a good guide dog, or is there? I know actually now, and we have an episode of Good Dog, where we talk to someone from Guide Dogs for the Blind, and they're breeding labs way more than German Shepherds now.
Yeah, actually, they told me a long time ago. I've gone to their campus several times, and it's a beautiful place. I could live there. Anyway.
You and hundreds of other people.
Right.
It's huge.
Yeah, it is. They told me that German Shepherds, a good, sound German Shepherd, there's nothing like that for a guide dog, because a good German Shepherd makes decisions. It will say, well, you know, I know the light just changed, but on the other hand, there's a very quiet Prius coming your way, and, you know, like an electric car or whatever, and so I'm going to stop, whereas labs have a tendency to just follow rules. So a good German Shepherd is wonderful, but that same sensitivity that makes them good decision makers also causes a good number of them to flunk from the system.
That sounds like reasoning, though, higher levels of brain functioning that we don't usually ascribe to dogs.
Yeah, well, we probably should. They can do some reasoning. I don't think that they're certainly not at our level. They don't have the neocortex that we have. But certainly they've been shown to be able to reason.
And there are brighter dogs and less bright dogs.
Yeah, although it might just be like pretty girls and not so pretty girls, you know? The prettier the girl, the less they have to use their brain.
Because there is a God.
Yes.
I say, because you don't find, as I tell my boys, you don't find the entire thing in one package, right?
Well, actually...
I'd go for the heart over the brains in a dog any day, wouldn't you?
Sometimes, but, you know, I'm a dog trainer, right? So...
You get the most out of them you possibly can.
This is what dog trainers do. They get a dog, and so I've got my German Shepherd Strider, who's the most wonderful German Shepherd in the world. He's my meet and greet dog. He can make any dog calm down. He's just a wonderful animal, but he's a nervous wreck when it comes to separation anxiety. So I have him for one reason, and then I have my Cairn Terrier, who's just full of vinegar. And
another thing that goes with it.
And another thing goes with it. And she is rock solid as far as, you know, being left and all that. She has no anxiety in her at all. So, you know, I have one dog for this and one dog for that. And then I've got my little mix of a dog who is just Mr. Cocky. And this is what dog people do. You know, when I go talk to groups of dog trainers, I don't talk to anybody who has just one dog. They have 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, they have a lot of dogs. They've got a dog for every need.
That's wild.
So.
And they all get along with one another?
Well.
Let's start with your three.
Oh, my three get along very well. In fact, there are
five. Of course,
five.
They have a pro for a mom, so that's different.
So they ought to, right? Yeah. But there are five dogs in our household, and they all get along very well. But the little cocky one that I was talking about, he's probably Bull Terrier and Border Collie and Basenji mix, the three Bs. We don't know for sure. But without a lot of management, he would probably bully the other dogs, and that wouldn't be good. So what I've done is I've made him into a ball-fetching addict. So when we're going for a walk, he's fetching the ball back and forth and back and forth, and he's not trying to play too hard with the other dogs because they're, you know, they don't play like he does. He's a bully dog, and he wants to muzzle punch them, just ram into them and roll them over, and he thinks that's fun, and they don't.
Each time we talk, I think of 12 new topics for shows. But my intention for this particular episode of Good Dog was to talk about what happens in class. Why, for instance, someone would, well, first of all, let me ask it as a question. Would you say that every dog should go to some sort of class?
Well, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of people who say, well, I took one of my dogs to a class, therefore I don't need to take any more of my dogs to a class. But I take my dogs to classes, and presumably, I mean, I teach classes, so, but I still take my dogs to classes because I won't work without the class. You know, without that weekly goal of what I'm supposed to be doing, I'm just as lazy as anybody else. I'll work on that next week. I'll work on that next week.
But you have to have it for the next class, like doing your homework,
right? That's right, exactly. It's
like we always say, I could teach myself to do X, Y, Z, but you really won't unless you go to a class.
That's right. And, you know, if you had...
So it's for you, or is it for the dog?
It's for both of us. So if you had three children, would you just send the first one to school?
Personally, no. Homeschooling, not for me. But plenty of people do it.
They do, and that they
have
to...
Takes a certain kind of person.
And they have to, yes, they have to be very self-motivated, and they have to be willing to get the kids to work. So classes are good for a few reasons. The first reason is that, especially with a new owner and dog, it helps the bonding process. Because if you actually develop a communication between the two of you that you might not have otherwise. An awful lot of people just kind of yell no at their dogs when they're doing something wrong. And then when they're doing something right, they don't say anything at all to them. And, you know, that's not necessarily the best way to be.
You could flip that, in effect.
You could, but most people don't. Punishment is the first thing out of in our brain. When a dog does something wrong, we yell at them.
Yeah, we do that to kids too.
Mm-hmm. It's not good, but it's there.
Better to praise and perhaps give a little treat.
Better to praise. Better to tell the dog he's doing something right, and certainly to discourage things being done wrong. But there might be a particular way you can discourage that would be better than another way. You know, for instance, in class, you might learn about body blocking to stop a dog from getting up on counters and you know, things like that. So it definitely helps the language between you and the dog. So if you say sit, they know what sit means, and they don't think it has to be repeated 7 times before the dog actually does it. Sit, 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 sit. Ah, now I sit, which is what I think a lot of dogs think. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it actually teaches useful exercises. There are not very many. There's like 6 of them, really. There's sit, down, stay, wait at doors, come, walk on leash, leave it. That's about it. All the way through, you know, 3 levels of school, you'll just be teaching variations of those. So, but those are all good things that help a dog live in our world. Because all the things that dogs want to do are all the things that we don't want them to do. So we have to actually inhibit their behavior.
For instance... What do they want to do that we don't want them to do?
Chew on furniture. Go chase butterflies. We don't mind that in our yard, but we don't particularly want them to do it someplace else when they won't come. You know, you name it. They want to do something, and we want them to do something else. If you're a little kid, you want to color on walls. If you're a mom, you don't want them to. So they got to learn how to inhibit behavior. So that's what we're doing, is we're inhibiting behavior. And then the third thing is that the dogs learn to work around other dogs and people. And it's great if you can afford a trainer to come to your home and train your dog in your home. But that will mean that your dog will obey you in your home. So in order to round out that education, you should probably take your dog to a class so that they can learn that, you know, it doesn't matter whether there are 5 dogs there or 10 dogs there. You still have to obey mom.
If your dog is, for instance, and mine is, fearful of larger dogs, is that something that you can really work on in a classroom setting?
Yeah, you would have to be, that the instructor would have to know about it. The other people in the class would have to know about it. It would depend on how fearful the dog is. So
she snarls. She looks mean. She's never done anything. Of course, I've always had her on a leash, and I've always... what I usually do is I pat the larger dog, and that lets her know that the dog is fine. But I'm not always going to... Well, maybe I am always going to be there to do that. But it seems that it's something that should be addressed.
Well, I think that probably should always be there if that's the case. Remember, dogs don't have to meet other dogs. The best thing to do is to teach her to ignore the other dog. And yes, she could learn that in a class. But that's why we oftentimes, for certain dogs, we might have a consultation, and then we'll recommend a particular class. So if you have a large dog, for instance, that barks and lunges but is not really aggressive, it might go into, we call it a difficult dog class. Other places call it a growly dog class or whatever. And those classes, the dogs learn how to ignore other dogs. And then if the dogs are good enough, they'll actually learn how to meet other dogs appropriately. But, you know, that's not a basic class. Basic classes are like, you know, levels 1, 2, and 3. And then we have a class that's really fun. It's called Agility Basics. And it's all got these little bitty pieces of agility equipment. So
little mini gyms for dogs.
Yeah. And so the dogs learn to do obedience, and then they also learn to go up and down in these little pieces of equipment. And this, your little Lulu, would be great in that class because she'd have something to think about, and there's something between her and the other dogs. The other thing that would be good for a little dog like Lulu, who's frightened of big dogs, is to take a class with other small dogs. That will start building up her confidence so that she'd be able to kind of just get some tolerance, you know, have her tolerance level grow. And then after that, she can go into a class where there are other dogs. Now she knows that she's safe with smaller dogs. She can be safe with larger dogs, too.
So you have different classes, all sorts of different classes.
Yeah, we have 35 different kinds. We have 35 classes a week, and we have about 12 different kinds of classes. You know, we have agility classes. We have fly ball classes. We have all kinds of things.
What are fly ball classes?
Oh, fly ball is a wild game. It's like a relay race for dogs, and it takes a lot of work. The dogs learn to jump over. There's two teams in the end. There's two teams. The dogs will jump over 4 hurdles. They grab a ball that's sitting just in a container, a holder. So they grab the ball, and then they come racing back over the jumps again, and they give the dog to their owner. So the first, you know, if they come back and they actually just have to drop the ball past the last hurdle, then the next dog goes. So it is, I mean, you know, the actual games are just really exciting. So to teach your dog to do this, you have to teach the dog to take a dead ball, that is to take a ball that's just sitting, to go over jumps, to not pay any attention to the dogs on the side of it, to wait its turn. There's all kinds of things that are really good for the dog to learn. And so we actually have a flyball team, but we also teach flyball.
What fun. So do dogs, and for instance, a dog like Lulu would have to maybe start out with some other class and work her way up to flyball?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This is for the varsity dogs.
Right. These are for our very athletic dogs. And they literally do have to be athletic. They have to be slim. They have to be, because you don't want them to have any injuries.
Okay, this is typical behavior for her. There's probably someone outside, a delivery person, or it could be anyone. Oh, look, it's a neighbor in a tree, and a young neighbor in a tree. Come here, Lulu. How do I get her to stop doing this? She will do this if a cat is walking across the fence, for instance, late at night. And, you know, we could be asleep. She has a, well, now what we've done is we've closed the doggy door at night, so she can't go out. Come here, sweetie. Come here. Come here. She's fine. I've got her. No, I just had her on a funny angle. She's fine.
You heard her.
So now we close the doggy door so that she doesn't get out, and that solved that problem. Mm-hmm. But
well, management, yeah, because you either have to call her back when she does it, and if she doesn't come, you have to go get her. So prevention first, and then stopping her in the middle of the behavior so she stops it, because she finds that very reinforcing. It's a lot of fun to bark, right?
I mean, I don't know.
Well, does it appear to be fun to her? She's wagging her tail, isn't she?
Well, right now she's wagging her tail. Yeah.
But I bet if you looked at her doing it, she'd be out there going, this is what I was put on earth for.
I am powerful.
Oh, boy, am I powerful.
I'm going to let you know.
So
now,
is
it territorial? Is that mm-hmm. what she's doing? She's mm-hmm. saying, get off my fence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's saying, I mean, the first dogs, one of the first signs the Romans had was cave canem, beware of the dog. There we are, you know, territoriality. And guard dogs are still used all over the world, including in our society. I actually had a funny incident this past week. These people wanted to adopt a dog, and they wanted the dog to be friendly to all their friends, but to be nasty to all strangers. I mean, to literally bark and try to bite them. And we said, well, I'm sorry, you're not going to adopt a dog like that here. What a chore for a dog to have to decide between the good, the bad, and the ugly. We can't do it half the time. And we're saying, okay, dog, you have to be able to do it. So dogs will have a
chance. Yeah, and what if they make a mistake?
And they will.
Of course.
Of course they will. So, you know, you have to say, well, if the dog is going to do this barking, then they'll probably do this barking, and I have to stop them from doing it. And you'll never stop her totally because she likes it so much.
So let's go through that again, because I suspect a lot of people have this sort of problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, eliminate her access.
Yeah, management.
Okay. So, for instance, bring her in the house.
Bring her in the house.
You can bring her in the house in a variety of ways, right? You can go up. I just went and picked her up and carried her over. Now she's sitting happily on my lap.
Or, yeah.
Neighbor is still in the tree.
Right.
And so I've distracted
her. You've actually told her that you're taking care of the problem by being the big, tall, strong person here. And that actually is a really important thing, isn't it? So the dog believes that I tell my mom that somebody's here, and then she takes care of it. So I don't have to worry about it anymore. And for Lulu, that's a really important thing. The other thing you can do is you can, if the dog is barking, you can kind of go round them up and push them back. Just kind of bodily push them back. And of course, you can also not allow them access to the backyard unless you are either there or are willing to go there to stop them from barking.
Reason to stop them from barking is just that she might be annoying someone.
Right.
That's it. Other than that, she's not causing any harm, right?
Right. That's absolutely true. The neighbors don't usually like it.
Mm-hmm.
It increases their arousal. So if, for instance, not Lulu, but if, for instance, you had a dog that got so aroused it started to bite at the fence or really seemed to be getting aggressive, then it would be practicing the wrong behavior. And you would really want to stop it from practicing that behavior. When you work with dogs that go into high arousal, a lot of them bark in the car when people come by. They go nuts in the car. And we do everything we can to help them calm down in the car so that they don't practice that behavior. Because practice makes perfect.
It is so true, right? And if you don't stop a behavior, it's in effect being cemented into place.
Right. As long as it's a behavior that is natural to the dog, and barking is natural to the dog. Now, stay is not going to get better, because a dog does not naturally do stay. Right? It has to be a behavior that they like to do.
I was never good at training a dog to stay. It's probably a tough one.
Yeah, it is tough. It's not really tough, though. It's usually that we're soft. We're like, oh, well, I don't see any reason why my dog should stay.
And we don't practice enough.
And we don't practice. And if you don't practice it, say, for instance, you go to a class and you've learned stay and the dog is doing it quite well during the class, and it can do a 3-minute stay with balls bouncing all over the place, which is pretty hard to do.
I've seen dogs do it. No dog of mine's ever been able to do it, but right. I have seen it done, and it's quite impressive.
So there you are. You're doing all this stuff, and you go, God, okay, my dog now knows stay. So then months go by. And one day you decide that you want your dog to stay again because maybe the refrigerator repairman comes over. So you say, okay, I want to stay. You tell your dog to stay. And the dog goes, huh? Because you haven't practiced this now for 2 or 3 months. And because of
and
that,
there aren't balls bouncing all up and down in his face and he's not at the play, at the Humane Society.
That's true. But even if you practiced it at home and then stopped practicing it for 2 or 3 months, it's not a natural behavior. So the dog is going to forget it. If it was a natural behavior, like bark at the refrigerator repairman, then the dog won't forget that.
Interesting. Is it, I mean, I know the answer to this question. The key with all of this is starting early, right? You want to get them into class as soon as possible?
Yeah. We start classes at 10 weeks. But even, you know, in my Family Dog 1 classes, I think the oldest dog I ever had was a 12-year-old.
Wow.
And I remember asking the person about it.
Yes. So you can teach an old dog new tricks.
You certainly can. But I said, you know, she seems like such a nice dog. You didn't really need classes. And she said, the woman said, well, you know, she's coming to the end of her life. And she said, I tried to think of something that I could do for her that would be just her and me.
Oh, how. That is so sweet.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And as it turned out, the dog died about, 6 months after class ended.
But had a nice time.
Had a great time in class, got all that attention from her owner, got daily practice. Her tail wagged the whole time she was in class. She was a happy girl.
How nice. Yeah. Finishing up with our discussion about classes. So you say that even if you have the resources to do private dog training, classes have their benefits as well. For most people, are classes enough?
For most people, they are, for sure.
And do you need to do this on an ongoing basis, or is one class pretty much enough?
Well, if you just want to send your kid to kindergarten, I guess it's okay.
Ooh.
It depends on what you want. Most people, essentially, a basic class is just that. It's like teaching your kid the ABCs. It does not teach them how to read. So you want to put the foundation in, and then it's good to take it further, but it depends on what people want. If they have a house dog, they go for a walk once a day, and they don't care if the dog pulls on the leash, and that's enough. Then that's fine. Essentially, the bigger the dog, the more powerful the dog, the more you need classes.
That's why we stick with these 20-pound and under dogs.
Well, you have the good companion dogs. I mean, this little one is a delightful little companion dog. It was an interesting, I was in Wisconsin doing a talk and was discussing with another trainer who does rescue about the different kinds of dogs that she rescues. And she said, and I haven't seen it, but it's quite possible she's right, that with dogs that have received no socialization, the dogs that are possibly not quite feral, but, you know, just have had a bad beginning. The dogs that make the best recovery are the companion dogs. And what you have, it's a cockapoo, right?
She's a peekapoo.
Peekapoo.
Not really.
She's a little hairy mutt.
She's a little mutt.
And her forebears are bred as companions. And because there are so many generations of companion dog in there, that they can make a fuller recovery than some of the other dogs that were used for other things, i.e. hunting, sled pulling, and whatnot, they sometimes have a harder time kind of re-socializing, if you want to put it like that. I don't know whether she's right or not, but it's an interesting thought.
Absolutely. So you can take as many classes as you want. It's a way to spend time with your animal one-on-one. They're fun.
Mm-hmm. They should be fun.
You'll get more out of it if you practice at home like everything else.
When I was first teaching classes a long time ago, we used to use what were called compulsive methods, where you essentially told the dog what it was doing right before you told the dog what it was doing wrong. I mean, the other way around. You told the dog what it was doing wrong before you told him what it was doing right. So if you wanted the dog to be walking next to you, for instance, you'd be pulling on the leash, tugging on the leash. And then when it did something right, you just stop tugging on the leash. So that was the reward, that there was no more pain to the neck. Now we do things a lot more it's a lot more pleasant. It's a lot more fun. And the biggest problem we have now is getting people to stop using the treats as they go on in training. They kind of get hooked on the treats and they use them forever and ever and ever. And
the people get hooked. Not the dogs.
Not the dogs. The people. You know, after a while, guilt comes in. They go, oh, well, I have to give him a treat for this. No, no, no. He knows that.
Yeah, I worked late today. I'll stop and buy him a cookie.
So, you know, it's a... I like the moderation. You know, you certainly there are things that dogs need to get told that they can't do. But there are a lot of things that when they're learning, they should just, it should be fun. Learning should be fun, should be interesting for both. And when we were doing compulsive training, people would stop at one class and they'd never come back because they didn't like what they were doing to their dog. They didn't even know they didn't like what they were doing to their dog. Nowadays, they come back for class after class after class. And people use it as social hour. You know, they get to know all the people in the other classes.
Well, and if you love dogs, more is better, right?
Mm-hmm. The only thing we do is we constantly have people saying they want to have more social time for their dogs, that they get to play with other dogs. And we don't do that in our classes past puppy classes because really they're supposed to be learning to pay attention to their owner, not to play with other dogs. If people want to set up play dates afterwards, I think it's great.
And there are dog parks springing up all over.
Mm-hmm. There are.
You can't always trust.
No.
She is Trish King, author of Parenting Your Dog. I'm Joanne Green. We would love to hear from you. Questions, comments, requests? gooddog@smarterpodcasts.com. Now go take a walk with your dog.